Creek Board of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning, you may be seated. First case on our calendar, 07-863, Ivanich, William Ivanich versus Stephen Bridge. Mr. Meckler.
Mr. Chief Justice, Your Honors, if it pleases the court, Stephen Meckler, I represent the appellants Stephen and Margaret Bridge. As the court knows, this is a matter involving an adverse possession dispute between two adjoining neighbors. I believe that the issues in this case are extremely narrow. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for my rebuttal. This case involved gardening or border decoration by the appellee who, when he bought his property, planted some border designs which actually encroached on the lot next door. About 12 years afterwards, the appellants bought that land, and there is no question that the appellees had that plantings and split rail fence that they put in on the appellant's property for more than 21 years. But I believe the issue here is one of intent. The cases that we believe support our position are Lane versus Kennedy, which is an 1861 case, and the Grace versus Cook case decided by this court in 1998. Those cases clearly indicate that the issue of intent is necessary. Now, historically, the issue of intent was presumed by the actions of the possessor, or the person who was attempting to get the property. However, our position is that that outward action of the person attempting to get possession is a rebuttable presumption, and that if, in fact, that person indicates that he had no intent to do it, then, in fact, it appears to me that the possession itself is not sufficient to sustain a finding of adverse possession.
How do you answer the argument that if we take that interpretation, we reward only the bad behavior, the person who knows they don't own the property, deliberately tries to exercise ownership over it, versus the person who innocently thinks he owns the property and still exercises the same possession over it?
Frankly, my position is that adverse possession in modern Ohio has no place or application whatsoever, particularly in a residential subdivision that's been platted with numbered lots and identified in a recorder's office, as it doesn't apply to, I believe, tornized property by statute. I don't believe it should apply at all. But your point is it does create an anomaly, because it appears that you are rewarding the thief while punishing the person who had no intention. But if the person who had no intention and honestly does it is in fact not interested in taking that property, then you're not punishing him. You're simply giving him what he wanted to begin with, which is his own property. And in this particular case, Mr. Ivanich admitted that he had no intention of going on his neighbor's property. It was an error, that had he known it was his neighbor's property, he never would have taken it. Even the Ninth Circuit, the Ninth District Court of Appeals, cites the Lane versus Kennedy and Grace versus Cook case to show the issues of intent. I think that the distinction that we're talking about is how do you presuppose intent? And in this particular case, I believe that Mr. Ivanich satisfied his burden of proof by coming forward and showing that his encroachment had been there for more than 21 years. He made a prima facie case. The burden was then on the defendant, the appellants herein, to overcome that presumption. And I believe they overcame that presumption when Mr. Ivanich testified on cross-examination that he had no intention of taking his neighbor's property, and had he known it was his neighbor's property, he wouldn't have done so.
Did your client live on the property before he realized, he did the survey and realized there was encroachment?
About 14 years.
And during those 14 years, they were perfectly content with each other with this piece of, 5 feet worth?
The encroachment actually is very small. It's 5 feet at the front of the property lots. But it goes back in a triangular thing to nothing at the rear lot. But, yeah, during that period of time, my client had no idea.
I mean, we have to sit here and say this case has been to the Court of Appeals twice. It's now to the Supreme Court over a 5-foot stretch of land that everybody was happy with for 14 years. I understand there's a legal principle here, but it sort of boggles my mind that people are fighting this long over this slim piece of property that they were happy with.
Well,
it probably cost them far less to even move it than they've been paying you to.
And I absolutely agree with the court's position on that. However, there's a certain feeling about people who own property that it's theirs and they want it. And it's an emotional attachment sometimes that overcomes the sensible approach in terms of resolving it. There were many attempts to resolve this before it went to trial.
It strikes us sort of like a child who doesn't want a toy until the other person has it, and he didn't know it was the other person's. And then he didn't want it until he knew it was the other person's.
Well, that sort of applies to Mr. Ivanich, too, because he didn't really indicate that he had an intent to take his neighbor's property until he found out it wasn't his. And then he said, well, now I want it.
This case requires us to decide whether we follow the objective test or the subjective test, doesn't it? And in Yetzel, we held to the objective test, that it doesn't matter what one's intention is, that what matters is whether the person occupied someone else's property adversely. Here, that's clearly the situation where neither party knew they owned where the property line was. And so Mr. Ivanich occupied land that your clients loaned. Wouldn't we have to overrule Yetzer if we reverse this case?
Well, first of all, I think Yetzer was on the facts a little different, but Yetzer does indicate that the intent to possess it is all that's relevant. I mean, the case says what it says. However, is an intent to possess the same thing as an intent to claim title? And I believe that Yetzer can be distinguished between Lane versus Kennedy and subsequently Grace versus Cook on that issue. And I think Grace versus Cook reaffirms the concept that intent may be presumed by the actions of the party, but in fact, it is a presumption that is not a legal presumption, but a factual presumption that can be overcome. And there are many cases that have held where there was no intent in fact, or no assertion of property rights, that in fact adverse possession doesn't apply, but Yetzer is what Yetzer is, and I understand that.
What's your strongest policy reason for urging us to adopt the so-called subjective test, where one knows they're on someone else's property, but they occupy it anyway for a period of time?
Well, without going into a history lesson, we all understand that the concept of adverse possession actually came over with English common law, where it was very difficult because the measurements were not by meets and bounds. They were get on a hill and look as far as you can and at your property kind of thing. And originally, there was an urgency back in the late 1700s to develop the Western United States into the Northwest Territory and ultimately through Louisiana. And there was a reason for it at that point, because people were getting huge land grants but not doing anything with them. And they were trying to encourage the citizenry to go west. But in modern Ohio, with the recording statutes that we have, and even with the exception made by Tornize Land, it appears to me that adverse possession is really on its way out and should be abolished. It's an unfair application. Now, let's talk about specifically the residential application of adverse possession. When you're dealing with adverse possession in a pre-plotted subdivision where everybody can go to the recorder's office and look and see exactly what their property line is, applying adverse possession to neighbors who inevitably will encroach because the houses are close together creates not only neighborhood feuds, but it creates more litigation. And the concept of having to get a survey every time you buy a house to make sure that adverse possession hasn't encroached on your property, or to go back to the prior title holders to find out if they encroached to determine whether there's adverse possession, seems to me an unfair burden to the person who's innocent, and that's the buyer. It appears to me that the person who was doing wrong, whether intentionally or unintentionally, should not be rewarded in this day and age by using somebody else's property.
Counsel, that argument might make sense if you're talking about landscaping. But what if a house is mistakenly built onto 5 foot onto the neighboring property, and it's been occupied for 21 years and nobody objects, and now we want the 5 foot back?
And I think that is an interesting question, and I say that the answer to that is the same thing on the flip side as if we didn't have adverse possession, and that is somebody is going to be hurt by that type of encroachment. But the solution isn't necessarily moving the house or cutting off part of the house. The courts have always had the authority to award money damages. And the person on whose lot it's been built, or the person whose house has been built on somebody's lot, has recourse against his builder or against some prior owner and title. I mean, that can be resolved by money damages. Everything doesn't have to be resolved by adverse possession and awarding ownership of that property to somebody else.
Counsel, in listening to your presentation and thinking about it, it would seem your suggested course of action would be the end. I mean, where you would really have us take this is pretty much an end to adverse possession, mm-hmm. because I would assume the realities of life are that almost all adverse possession comes about not because somebody goes out and flies the flag intending to do it, but because there was a misunderstanding as to the realities of where a property line was. Almost all cases of adverse possession over time, it would seem to me, happened because someone misunderstood where the boundaries of the true boundaries of their property actually were.
Well, Mr. Justice Pfeiffer, I think that the studies show that you're absolutely correct, that the great majority of cases involving adverse possession come from a mistaken understanding of where the boundary line is.
And some of that is being cleaned up, or it would seem to me more and more incidents of mistaken property lines are going to come tumbling out. There's probably a lot more of this than anybody realizes, but it's going to come tumbling out because of modern technology. County auditors are sending people notices, look, we've now done satellite pictures and your property line's in the wrong place. You need to get a new survey and those kinds of things. That's happening today.
It has happened. And I believe that the end of adverse possession, whether it be now or whether it be in the next century, the end of the abolishment of adverse possession, as the Court of Appeals said in the Grace versus Cook case that this court subsequently affirmed, is that it should be abolished, and I believe its end is inevitable. It's unfair, and it has no application today. I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Meckler. Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. This case, if you'll indulge me, reminded me of a poem by Alfred Lord Tennyson. To the premise of which was that if you pluck a flower from a crannied wall and you understand it, root and all and all, you will know what God and man is. This is a small case, but it touches upon things which are very fundamental to our system of justice and reflects upon what courts do well and what they do not so well. The appellant has urged upon you, as I think that you've noted, an abandonment of a theory of adverse possession which this court has embraced since 1866, as articulated in the case of Yetzer versus Thoman. One of the things that intrigued me in my research of this case is that that case was a very self-conscious decision by this court back then. to embrace one of two theories of adverse possession, which both of which had a certain currency at that time. And the theory that they embraced was the one espoused by Connecticut. It was called the Connecticut Rule in a case of French versus Pierce, that said that the intention of the occupier should have no place in the inquiry, that what was important were those physical indications of possession that occurred on the land and which evidenced an intent to possess. If any intent is important, it's not so much the intent to claim title, but the clear intent to possess. And how do you know that somebody intended to possess something? By what he did on the land. The other side of the case, the other theory that had currency at that time was the so-called Maine test, which was espoused in, I think, a case called Preble in Maine, which said that an intent, the proper intent was an element of the claim, that you had to have the intent to claim the property of another. In other words, you had to have what is called by the authorities bad faith to be successful in the claim. Preble specifically said that if the occupier believed that he was only occupying to his lot line, his claim to adverse possession was legally insufficient. So this court knew what was out there in 1866. It knew the two theories that were being discussed in this connection, and it came down squarely in favor of the Connecticut rule, the objective rule, in which intention is unimportant.
Counsel, I asked this of your opponent, so it's only fair to ask it of you. Your client thought he owned the property, so that's your position is the intent didn't matter, correct?
That's correct.
But he now concedes that he did not own the property, and that's why he's asserting adverse possession?
That's correct.
Did he ever get an estimate as to how much it would cost to move 5 feet of shrubbery and one fence?
Your Honor, that's clearly not part of the record, but I don't know the answer to that.
You have to understand that it kind of boggles our mind that you're up here.
Yes.
But I understand there's a legal principle you're fighting for, but I just had to ask.
Yes. In any event, I want to get back to that point because it's interesting. But the question is, what did Grace versus Cook do? I mean, was it an intentional departure from, you know, the theory of law that this court has kind of embraced over the years? And I would suggest to the court that first of all, it was not a mistaken property line case on its face. And there were a number of pronouncements in that case. One is that what is critical is the intent to possess, not the intent to claim title. But there is that troublesome phrase, which the appellees have latched onto, that what is important is the intent to claim title as manifested by objective acts, which give rise to a presumption that if somebody doesn't do something in response to those things, that there has been an abandonment or relinquishment of his claim. I would suggest that Grace should not be seen as a categorical repudiation of Yetzer, that perhaps the language that was cited in there was used a little bit loosely and wasn't intended to be scrutinized quite as it has been in this case in this particular context. The question that you raise relates to one of the underpinnings of why we should have adverse possession at all, and that's certainly a question that crossed my mind as I researched this case, as it did Mr. Meckler's. I can say that, as far as I know, every state in the Union has either common law or statutes that provide for adverse possession. So I guess, as my mother would say, everybody else is doing it, why shouldn't we? That might not be the best answer, but it certainly indicates that there is a body of feeling that there's a justification for this law.
Mr. Carlson, if you
Yes.
look at Grace versus Cook and the syllabus, which at that time we were talking about the law being stated in the syllabus, it seems that the principle is to say there must be clear and convincing evidence on every point, and the intent that we're discussing now, whether it's objective or subjective, would you say that that goes to the element of adversity?
It does. And I think that you are right to point out that I think that the importance of grace in the context of adverse possession claims is that it established the clear and convincing evidence test. Of less importance, it seems to me, was this other language that we're struggling with. But clearly, the nature of what constitutes hostility and what constitutes intent in this body of law is very important. In the context of the objective test, what is important is that the use is non-permissive, that hostility arises out of that simple fact, not out of a subjective mental state of malice or intending to steal somebody's property. What is important is that it's not permissive. It doesn't necessarily flow from a claim of color of title. It's just, and what makes it hostile are those things that are done on the land which evidence this intent to possess, which is non-permissive. And all of those things relate to objective findings of fact. And I want to get back to that point. But one of the underpinnings
of this—
Mr. Carlson,
before you move on with your argument, I'm concerned with whether or not you agree with Yetzker.
I agree with Yetzker.
All right. And is there anything further for us to write in amplification of the holding in the Yetzker case?
Yes. I think this court should clarify the meaning of the language in Grace versus Cook, should embrace Yetzker, and should distinguish that language, should again re-embrace the objective test for adverse possession.
What is the confusion between the court's statement disavowing the trial court's charge that says you cannot commit adverse possession by mistake because the intent of the possessor to claim adversely is an essential ingredient? And the Supreme Court said, we're of the opinion that charge is erroneous. I mean, they pretty clearly said in Yetzker, this doesn't come from mistake or intent.
Absolutely.
Now, what more is there that you would have us write?
I agree with you entirely. That's what Yetzer clearly says. Intention makes no difference, should make no difference. The phrase in Cook that is troublesome is that you must have the intent to claim title. The appellee's argument argue that to have that intent.
So are you suggesting that Cook is inconsistent with Yetzker, and that's what we need to clarify here?
Yes, that's exactly right, Your Honor.
Excuse me, I have one question about that. I don't necessarily read the having the intent to claim title as necessarily a recognition that you don't have title and therefore you're going to assert actions that will eventually allow you to claim title. Isn't it that you intend to claim title here and now? You intend to proclaim that this property is yours, however you manifest that, by the plantings or the landscaping or building upon it. That, to me, is what they mean when they say intent to claim title. Not necessarily I'm going to hold my breath for the requisite amount of years and then I'm going to hope that I can establish title. It's here and now. I'm going to act as though this land is mine. And it doesn't matter that I don't know that it's not mine.
Well, I'm gratified to hear you say that, because I think that certainly is a permissive reading of that language in Grace versus Cook, that it's not necessarily inconsistent with Yetzer, as the appellees seem to argue that it is. So when I ask for clarification, it's just on that single point. The court has inquired about, you know, why we have gone to such lengths over such a small piece of property, which may be the most expensive piece of property outside of Manhattan Island by now. But one of the intriguing things I found in my research was the quote by Oliver Wendell Holmes, as to the underlying justification for adverse possession. And he said, the true explanation of title by prescription seems to me to be that man, like a tree in the cleft of a rock, gradually shapes his roots to his surroundings, and when the roots have grown to a certain size, can't be displaced without cutting at his life. One of the things he's saying there is that people who occupy property for a long period of time become very much identified with that property. They, as in this case, assume that it's owned by them. And the longer they occupy it in that manner, the more the attachment is to that piece of land.
Counsel,
yes.
Just to play with you a little, the Holmes quote I could understand. The poem that you started with, I didn't understand.
Maybe they're both talking about clefts and rocks. But I guess what I was intending to say was that this is a small piece of law, but it kind of touches on fundamental issues in our jurisprudence relating to property and under what circumstances we can change the property of one to another without compensation.
Okay.
Another thing that I think it reflects upon is what courts do and do well. And it seems to me that what they do best is apply mechanically rules of law and evidence that suggest clear outcomes to things. And when you start to discuss subjective states, not that there aren't places in the law where those are important, you inject an uncertainty into the inquiry. Things that are done on the land, what's being done there, how extensive is it, what kind of notice it puts the owner on, those are all things that are capable of kind of clear and definite proof. The argument that we should somehow bring this subjective intent back after a presumption is created still leaves us with the issue of mental state. And again, I clearly suggest to the court that mental state, whether good or bad, has no place in this inquiry. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Meckler, you've saved almost 2 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I guess I'm faced with the possibility, a problem with overcoming Alfred Lord Tennyson and Oliver Wendell Holmes. However, as interesting as they may be, historically, land is everything. And if I may indulge, John Adams, our second president of the United States, after he retired from the presidency, went back to his farm, and that's all he wanted to do. And his position all through his life was that ownership of land was everything. And Ohio has always recognized that ownership of land is sacrosanct. It is an important aspect of property rights. To say that going to the subjective rather than the objective creates a problem in evaluating intent is to fly in the face of the fact that courts and juries do this all the time.
Well, courts, counsel, let me take you back to an even more ancient president. George Washington was a surveyor, and among the places he surveyed was southern Ohio. And some of those surveys are notoriously bad. And people have been observing, however, the survey lines that he established, thinking that they owned that. So now, if a satellite flies over and said, geez, you know, not off by a few feet, but we're off by acres and acres, do the property lines have to move to where they are correct by modern day standards, or even though neither property owner knew that one or the other was encroaching?
Well,
under your theory of practice, that what the satellite tells us today rather than what George Washington told them a couple hundred years ago is going to control.
I'm not suggesting that this court abolish adverse possession to the extent where it retroactively goes back to anything that was ever done. I would suggest that the legislature passed the Marketable Title Act, which in fact clears up any titles going back, I believe, 40 years. It appears to me that resolves that problem. And I think to say that we need the objective standard indicates a lack of faith in the courts and the juries to evaluate the truth and the intent of parties who are testifying with regard to adverse possession. The ownership of property is just so inviolable that it offends my concept to allow somebody to come in and take it without paying.
Mr. Meckler, in this instance, with the case authority of the court so entrenched for so many years, in order for us to disavow a concept like adverse possession, we would have to disavow all of our precedent from this court, would we not?
No, I don't believe so. I think that...
But we have a decision in Yetzer that tells us at least a formula for resolving an issue like this.
Well, actually, Yetzer...
And if we would overrule that, we would have to go through our decision in Gallatus, and you haven't performed that analysis.
Well, it seems to me that Yetzer, in part, deals with mutual mistake of the parties, which I suppose could be taken up one step to acquiescence in a mutual boundary line. I don't believe that's the case here, although there was some talk in the Court of Appeals decision about mutual mistake. I don't think it was mutual at all. There was a mistake made by the appellee, and subsequently, two owners later, the third owner, my clients, moved into the property, but they didn't mutually accept that decision. It was a unilateral mistake, and I think under those circumstances, you can distinguish this from Yetzer. But Cook reiterated the necessity of intent. Our position is that intent is, in fact, not objective, but it is subjective. And once Mr. Vantage said, I didn't intend to do that, his period of adverse possession starts then. It doesn't go back 22 years.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meckler.
Thank you very much.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.